Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Normally, being a little extra might be a bit much, but not when it comes to healthcare. That's why UnitedHealthcare's Health Protector Guard fixed indemnity insurance plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, supplement your primary plan so you manage out-of-pocket costs. Learn more at uh1.com.
Hello and welcome to Seriously, the New Statesman podcast that takes pop culture seriously.
I'm Caroline Crampton.
And I'm Anna Leskovich. This week, we're talking about the This Country special called The Aftermath and Desiree Akhavan's new Channel 4 show, The Bisexual.
We've also watched Jodie Whittaker's first episode of Doctor Who, so we'll be talking about how that went later in the show.
Hello.
Hello.
Welcome back to another episode of Seriously. I just spent a weekend in Cheltenham for the Cheltenham Literature Festival, which was really nice. Cheltenham is where I'm from. It's quite weird seeing the kind of depressing, damp parks of your youth turned into kind of the glitzy, I don't know, middle-class festival site that the Cheltenham Literature Festival is. It's all kind of fairy lights and big tents and like vintage buses selling cocktails. What? Is a thing. Like a big kind of, there was a big mint double-decker London bus, but in this very tasteful mint green that was giving out, or, well, you bought them, where you could go and buy a gin and tonic or something. So that's very much the vibe of the Cheltenham Literature Festival, which is kind of in keeping with the general vibe of Cheltenham, but not the Cheltenham that I was sort of part of growing up. And yeah, the site of much of the Literature Festival is just like this kind of quite empty park or gardens most of the year. And I just really associate it with cans of Strongbow in the middle of the night being, I remember, you know, getting your alcohol taken off you by some sort of like community support policeman, them tipping it onto the grass in front of your sad little face. That's mainly what I remember it from. But yeah, I went to see Sally Rooney speak, which was great. And it's a cool thing every year. I just wish that I could like take 2 weeks off work and actually do it properly. But alas, I cannot.
Yeah, I do always wonder with literary festivals, like, who goes to them? Because they do always look really cool.
They look retired, most of the people at these festivals.
Yeah, that's my inevitable conclusion, is that they are mainly aimed at retired people who can go to multiple book-based events on weekday evenings.
Yeah, you're either retired, you live in the town, or you're working for the Times and Sunday Times. That's the impression that I got.
Okay, yes, fair enough.
But it was cool to pop in and out, and I took my dog to Cheltenham for the first time, so that was really nice.
So actually, what you're saying about cans in the park being different to the glitz and glamour makes me think a lot of what we're going to talk about first this week.
Oh yeah, true. The first thing we're going to talk about this week is This Country, a BBC Three mockumentary set in Gloucestershire. Holla! Written by and starring siblings Daisy May and Charlie Cooper. It's already been picked up for a third season, which airs in 2019, and the one-off special titled The Aftermath just aired. So yeah, we've talked about This Country a lot on Seriously because we're both big fans. I'm a huge fan partly because I grew up in Gloucestershire, about 20 minutes away from where this is filmed. And it's just really, the humour translates completely, whether you know anything about rural Gloucestershire or British life at all, or whether you've grown up in somewhere boring, or whether you know, even if you're London born and bred, the humour in it is very translatable. It's just really silly and funny. And this special comes just after the second season, and the second season ended on a bit of a cliffhanger. Spoiler alert for anyone who hasn't seen the end of the second season or hasn't seen the special, just go away, watch it. I think it's still all available on iPlayer. You need to go and watch it. We can't recommend it enough. But the second season ended with Kerry being about to make the decision of whether or not to take the blame for her dad's crimes, which were stealing and storing a bunch of stolen Hoovers in his house and in a lockup that Kerry was owning in her name and in the bowls club where Curtin works. And she was just about to decide whether or not to take the blame for Martin Mucklow. And he was kind of saying things to her, like she was saying to him, oh, you'll write to me in prison, won't you, Dad? And he was saying like, well, I'm very busy, Kerr, actually. Don't know if I'll have time to write to you in prison. and Kerry's kind of like a sick puppy who can't help but do anything her dad says, even though he's visibly a reprehensible character to everyone else in the show and everyone watching. And that's kind of where a lot of the tension for her character and her storyline has come from over the past couple of seasons. And it's also where a lot of the humor comes from, but it's like completely heartbreaking humor. And there is a line in it where Kerry says something like, oh, you know, a lot of people have said to me now, like, you've got to stop looking out for your dad, Kerr. It's embarrassing. You know, it's just got completely heartbreaking at this point, to be honest. And it's so funny. So yeah, that's where the current special starts off. And I was really delighted with the direction they went with in this special.
Me too. It's so, so good. And I'd say the mockumentary style works even better, I think. You know, it works great in the regular series, but I think it works even better for like a one-off sort of responding to a specific event like this, because it makes even more sense that you would like interview different people in the community at different points to sort of get their take. And yeah, just when it's all surrounding like this one pivot point, it's really, really good. And so yeah, it's never quite explained how far on it is, but it's like a few weeks, right? So
I think it's a few months, because they've done the trial and everything,
right? Yeah.
I think they say maybe say something like the last 7 months or something, but I can't quite remember. But yeah, so you're not sure whether Kerry's basically going to be locked up in prison or whether she's going to be out and about in the town as she has been when the episode starts.
Yeah, but it's quickly revealed that she is free because she testified against her dad.
It's revealed in a really wonderful way where you see Curtin kind of knocking about as he always is, and then he shows you the BBC News videos or clips on his telly of the coverage of the trial, and there's a big still of the kind of court drawing of Martin, Curtin and Kerry, in which they all look absolutely hideous. And he's kind of saying like, no human looks like that. And it's really, I've like three different people sent me the screenshot of the drawing, like, oh my God, I was in bits kind of thing. And then the camera just swivels to Kerry going like, all right, mate, calm down. Kind of, and you're like, oh yay. And it's a real like, yay, she's there sort of moment quite early on. But I've watched this twice now with different people both times, and the super fans were like so delighted at that moment, and then there are some people who haven't watched it as closely who are just like, yeah, cool. So like, I think if you've been following the narrative of like Kerry not stopping at anything for her dad, and then you see her just sat there, it's just such a relief. And you know, this show does veer into the bleak at times, and I'm really pleased that they didn't make this some sort of bleak storyline where Kerry has served time for her dad. I think it wouldn't have been a great decision. But yeah, so we get straight back into it, and just after we see those clips, we see that Kerry is, to quote the vicar, behaving like the Antichrist, and she's going around being antisocial, acting out because she can't cope with these conflicting feelings she's now having about her father. And there's just some great moments of her sort of like on her BMX in the newsagent, or she like just punches Curtin in the arm out of nowhere and then goes, sorry.
And my favorite one was where she just like pulls some ivy off a wall and then throws it on the floor, just like, ah!
So that's the premise of the episode. And she also kind of gets to know her stepbrothers and her dad's partner as a way to kind of cope with what's happening. Meanwhile, we find out Curtin's lost his job at the Bowls Club. So his storyline is about coming to terms with that. And I think they're such typical, perfect, fairly low stakes, smallest country style plot lines, but there's so much genuine feeling in them, because even though they seem very low stakes on the surface, in that, well, this bowls job for Curtin, is that really that big of a deal? Like, he can get a different job, who cares? And, you know, yeah, Kerry's finally realised that her dad's an arsehole. We've known that for ages, whatever. But to both of the characters, of course, they're like incredibly monumental things in their lives. Mm-hmm. And so it's really, I don't know, I always think that the mix of kind of like hysterical, funny, ridiculousness and the like genuine heartstring pulling, like, God, this actually means quite a lot to these characters. Balance is struck really well in this country.
Yeah, I felt that especially strongly in Curtin's storyline with the bowls club, and I absolutely loved all of the tiny little details where, you know, he's reminiscing about like, oh, Frank will be, you know, bending down around now to tie up his shoelace. You know, he knows the place so well, it's part of him, and now he's been turned out of it, and it's really devastating. You know, there's a bit where he's talking with Slugs about, you know, getting over a relationship, and Slugs is clearly talking about a partner, and Curtin is talking about the bowls club as like someone who broke up with him and a relationship he now has to get over.
It's
really adorable, and I feel especially since the last series of This Country was on, I've had a summer of living in a village with two bowls clubs. So now I recognise even more how well observed all of the like bowls club drama is.
I really love he can't stop himself from going to have a sneaky look at what the bowls club are up to. And there's a line that just really had me in bits where he, obviously the bowls club are all a slightly older clientele, and they look exactly the same as they did in the last series, the series before, but you just hear Curtin go, they've all aged so horribly as well. And that really got a good laugh out of me. My favourite moment, though, of the whole episode was definitely near the beginning, where you get this montage of Kerry acting out, and it cuts to her doing some community service, which is what she's had to do for her role in her dad's Hoover stealing crime. And it's her reading The Cat in the Hat to the visually impaired. So she's describing the pictures on the page as she's reading out, in a very kind of like stilted reading voice, the words on the page. And she just says something like, and then we've got a drawing of a cat wearing a very much too large of a hat. And there's a goldfish in a bowl going, doing a face as if to say, what the fuck? And I believe it's in connection with the hat. It's just so funny. And like, they're so skilled at just bringing these kind of nostalgic, childish observations into this comedy. There's a moment where Kerry's teaching her stepbrothers how to run. And she's like, you have to hold your hands like this really sharp so that they're more aerodynamic. And like, stuff like that is just such a genuine, like, it just makes me think like, oh yeah, you did say shit like that when you were a kid and you did believe things like that. And they just bring that into the script in such a natural way. It never feels forced, you know, when they're talking about pogs or whatever, it never feels like they're just trying to shoehorn a reference in. But also the texture of it is so based in those kind of like things that you do as a child out of complete boredom. And that's where the arrested development element of it comes in. And it just is pitch perfect every time. I can't get enough of it.
Yeah, I cannot wait for another series. Apparently they start filming it early next year. I think I was reading the show's Wikipedia page after I finished watching this because I wanted more stuff. And apparently it only takes them about a month to film a series of this.
Yeah, I think it's actually, you know, it was a very low budget production when it started. They used the same sets and the same shots quite a lot. And I think they do a lot of like, not improvisation, because I think the script is fairly locked down, but you know, there's always in the credits additional material, the cast.
Yeah.
So I think they're flexible with it, and I think that's why it feels so natural when you watch it.
Normally, being a little extra might be a bit much, but not when it comes to healthcare. That's why United Healthcare's Health Protector Guard fixed indemnity insurance plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, supplement your primary plan so you manage out-of-pocket costs. Learn more at uh1.com.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, to get 30, to get 20, 20, 20, to get 20, 20, to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
There's never been a faster or easier way to start your weight loss journey than with PlushCare. PlushCare accepts most insurance plans and gives you online access to board-certified physicians who can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Take charge of your health and speak with a board-certified physician about a weight loss plan that's right for you. Get started today at PlushCare.com/weightloss. That's PlushCare.com/weightloss. PlushCare.com/weightloss.
So next we're going to talk about The Bisexual, which is a Channel 4 drama written by and starring Desiree Akhavan. She plays Layla, who starts the series as the work and life partner of Sadie, who's played by Maxine Peake. But very soon, the couple are on a break and Layla is experimenting with dating men for the first time in her life. Now, you recommended this to me. I hadn't actually heard of it coming at all. And so I was interested to read a little bit about the background. And I found that apparently she took, because Desiree Akhavan is Iranian-American, she had taken this to like every network in the US and been told no. And then it was Channel 4 who finally gave it a chance.
Yeah, which is amazing
because it's so slick and polished. And like, I found it really, really funny in a lot of places. That I find it bizarre that like HBO or Netflix or somewhere didn't want it. But whatever, it's our gain over here in Britain, I guess.
Yeah, it is. And I feel like, you know, some American glitz and glamour is always great for British broadcasters like Channel 4. But one thing that is really amazing about this is that it's all set in London. And Desiree Akhavan, as you say, is Iranian-American, but she has spent a lot of time mm-hmm. in London, and that really shows in this drama, which is set in a London that I know completely, and some programs set in London are not set in a London that I know, and that's neither necessarily a compliment or a criticism, because there are obviously parts of London and, you know, types of people living in London that I'm just not interacting with all the time, but like this felt really genuine to me. They go to a club night in the first or second episode that I've been to several times called Aphrodite, and there's like a little joke about Hampstead ladies yeah. ponds at one bit, like, and just the, you know, even there's a bit where they go to the Red Lion on Hoxton Street, and it just feels very, very real and genuine. And also a lot of the humour comes from that setting and comes from the kind of social satire that they're doing. But it's never, to me, feels like straightforward mockery, which is, I think, so easy to do. For example, there's a bit where they all go to a performance art night, and instead of it just being straightforward, like, look at these idiots watching this idiotic performance art, aren't they delusional and pretentious and vapid? Instead, it's like they're allowed to be moved, and it's allowed yeah. to be like a genuine thing that they have. So I think the London setting is why I sort of wanted to recommend this, and the way that they've presented London in it is really interesting and really good.
I also think that maybe if it had ended up being made in America, they wouldn't have cast Maxine Peake, which would have been a great loss because she is fantastic in this. Like, the very first 5 minutes of the show, which takes the form of Layla and Sadie being like interviewed by a really obnoxious journalist, because, as I said, like, as well as being life partners, or not life partners as it turns out, but partners, they are business partners, and they're about to launch, I think, what they call Shazam for clothes or Shazam for fashion or something.
Yeah.
They don't really go into it, but so they're being interviewed as like cool lesbian entrepreneurs.
I mean, it sounds good though.
It does. Shazam for clothes. Yeah.
I know all of these like Uber for whatever things, that's normally a phrase you use to mock something, but I would like to be able to just take a photo of someone on the high street and then get the outfit.
That would be great. Yeah. So apparently that is the app they're they're launching. And so basically within the first 5 minutes, you get this incredible dynamic between Maxine Peake and Desiree Akhavan, where they're like both trying to seem like a loved up couple for the interviewer, but at the same time, their answers keep diverging on questions like, do you want to have kids or stuff like that? Mm-hmm. Which just immediately makes you think like, uh-oh, this is not going well. And then there's a really awkward bit where Maxine Peake proposes while they're in the loo. And at the same time, Desiree Akhavan's like, actually, can we, you know, maybe take a break for a while? And that's the kind of setup of the whole thing. And I think you need an actor of Maxine Peake's quality to make that seem plausible. Otherwise, because she's not in it a huge amount after that, she would seem too much like a plot device, I think. Whereas even in that first like 5-10 minutes, I was really invested in her character. Like, I really want to know more about her.
Mm-hmm. And you need to get a sense of the risk that Layla, Desiree Akhavan's character, is taking by leaving Sadie, Maxine Peake's character, because they have a very secure relationship and a very loving relationship, and all their friends overlap. And you want, on top of all those kind of contextual, practical elements, you want to feel compelled by their relationship. And even though, as you say, it becomes immediately clear that they do have all these problems, you are compelled by their relationship. And I don't know how the series ends, but if the series did end with them getting back together, I would be completely fine with that, and I would buy it. But at the same time, the reason that Layla wants to have this break is perhaps... there's the underlying reason, although she doesn't articulate this to Sadie or even anyone at the beginning of the show, is that she is feeling like she has unexplored feelings for men, and that she maybe is bisexual. And so she starts dating men. And that's when this show kind of becomes like a dating show, essentially. And I think it's a really good one, because I think it's really realistic. But often, sometimes dating comedies that profess to be realistic go really far in the direction of being like bleak and depressing. Whereas what I really like about this show is that it shows sex and dating as like imperfect, but not without joy and not without like connection. And so she meets the male friend of her housemate, who's this kind of desperately heterosexual 36-year-old called Gabe, who's like sleeping with his younger student. And, you know, he's really as embarrassingly straight as you can get, and he brings a friend, he introduces her to a friend, and she starts sleeping with him, and he's really nice, and like they have really good sex, even though it's like messy sex. And there's like, you know, the sex scenes in this involve like farting and queefing and like embarrassed giggles and, you know, people getting bored and stopping halfway through, and or people zoning out to think about returning a Zara dress. But they're also having fun.
My personal favorite sex moment in this show comes quite early on when I think it's her first night in the new apartment, and she can hear Gabe and his student having sex through the wall, and so she gives up on trying to masturbate and instead puts an episode of This American Life on her phone and just like lies next to it and listen to it to try and drown out the noise, which I thought was very funny.
Yeah, which is funny. Yeah, and I like that the sex can be both imperfect and still like pleasurable for characters, because I think TV tends to go one way or the other, where it's like, this is a really great sex scene that's like completely unrealistic, and they manage to whip their clothes off in 3 seconds, and they haven't thought about protection or had any conversations or anything. And then the other end of the spectrum, which is like, God, she's really hating this. It's so bleak and depressing. Isn't that funny how bleak and depressing it is? And it's like, well, no, it's not funny. It's kind of just awful in a low level way that we all know. But yeah, so I really enjoyed that element of this. And I think I'm excited to see where it goes, because it's not like they introduce her to this one male character and it's like, right, that's her love life plotline sorted. I think quite quickly that moves on and she starts looking for other people. So yeah, that again feels interesting and dynamic.
Yeah, and I've been reading some really interesting responses to it. Dazed had a really good panel of bisexual writers writing about what it means to them, which we'll link to because I thought it was really interesting. And they were really focusing in on some of the ideas about how cool it is to see this kind of dating show with this kind of sexuality expressed in it, and also not have it be a kind of necessarily angsty, taboo breaking, awful, but just be like a funny, cool, sexy show, but specifically about this particular person's profile. But then on top of that, they were mentioning a lot, and this is something that I think the show really brings out, which is the problem, well, not the problem, but like the difficulty that bisexual people navigate is this idea that you're kind of maybe don't feel completely part of like the gay world, but neither do you feel completely part of the straight world. And that's sort of how Layla's character is portrayed as well. Like by breaking up or going on a break with Sadie, she's leaving her kind of secure, comfortable in a relationship lesbian world. But at the same time, she doesn't want to present as like a single straight woman either, because that's not what she is. So these writers were really interesting on like how that resonated with them. And I found that really interesting.
Yeah, that's really fascinating, because Layla's part of an incredibly solid, tight-knit, supportive lesbian community, which is great to see on TV, because again, that's not even something you normally see on TV. Like if you like, shows often have gay and lesbian characters, but you don't quite so much get that sense of like, oh, and here are the other six fleshed out lesbian characters. Like that doesn't really happen. And that has happened on this program, which I love. And I think a lot of the anxiety that Layla feels, some of it is real and some of it is not. And I think it's striking quite a good balance of saying like, God, she's feeling a bit ostracized from the lesbian community without being like, lesbians are as bad as straight people. Like it's done thoughtfully. And I really like that. One thing I also really like, not to totally talk about this in terms of representation, but this is a show about kind of like young hipsters in the vein of like lots of, you know, a lot of shows get labeled as like young hipster shows, like whether it's Girls or Search Party or whatever, and it's one of those, but it's about people who are like
it's about slightly older. It's interesting actually. I was sort of looking around today for how different reviewers had responded to this, and I think in general you can characterize the response where younger critics have really liked it and slightly older critics maybe haven't. But a really interesting exception to that is Hugo Rifkind, who I think is possibly even in his 40s, straight white man. And he wrote that he really liked it. And he said that it's really a show about people who set out to carve themselves new pioneering alt culture identities in their 20s, then find themselves deep into their 30s with no clear roadmap for what comes next. Which I think is really accurate, actually. And that's so interesting, because you're right that often like a cool hip show is like, we just finished college, we're millennials, lol, what do we do now?
Yeah, and like our lives are so unstable and we don't know who we are and we're just forming our identities. And like this is actually more like the characters in it are more thoughtful than that about their own lives, even if they are still, you know, navigating questions of identity and stuff. And it's nice to see that actually, you know, you don't leave college, form a new identity, and then become like a put together 30-something person. Like that's
everything's
not really
just
how
fine.
Life works.
That's the idea. Yeah. Whereas, this is totally interrogating the idea that you only have one identity through your life as well. That you can feel differently at 35 than you might at 25. Obviously, people definitely
totally.
Do.
And like it balances lots of different things. Like this is a show about dating, yes, but it's also a show about friendships, and it's a show about work, and it's a show about families and at what age you decide to start families. And it's covering a lot of ground for me. And I really like that Sadie, Maxine Peake's character, she's finding herself now out of a long-term relationship, just as Layla is. She's not looking actually to experiment or to, you know, make big changes in her life in terms of you know, dating new people. She was at a point where she wanted to get married and have children. And she's still at that point just because she's not in a relationship anymore. So it's that question of how she navigates, you know, maybe wanting to be a mother. Already it's quite challenging. You know, there are complications that you have as a gay person that you wouldn't have as a straight person in that question. And now she's a single gay person. It's even more complicated. So I just love that there's all these different, often underrepresented, underportrayed storylines going on here, but it manages to be funny. And it's not like the funniest thing I've seen on TV in a while. Like it's not like super laugh out loud funny for me. It's more like that laugh of recognition funny,
which can be really pleasant but sometimes. That's not necessarily to say that it's not funny.
So it's managing to do that and be compelling. And I like that, you know, she's kind to her characters even as she takes the piss out of them, which I think is really difficult to do. It's difficult to write a comedy about kind of inherently funny people and not kind of laugh at them too much. And she doesn't do that. She's really like generous with them. And I think, you know, you want, for most of these characters, you want them to have a good life, regardless of whether or not they get back together or meet new people or whatever. So yeah, that's the actual thing that's compelling me to watch, is not that I'm finding it a super hilarious comedy, but that I'm like genuinely interested in the characters and I want to see what happens next to them. So yeah, it's really fascinating. Yeah,
I'm really into it, and I hope it continues past its current 6 episodes, I think. So last week I recommended, subjected Anna,
cajoled
Anna into watching the first episode of the new series of Doctor Who, which is called The Woman Who Fell to Earth. And it's the first episode to star Jodie Whittaker as the Doctor. So Anna, how did you get on with it?
Yeah, what a title, The Woman Who Fell to Earth, because it immediately makes me think of like Bowie and, you know, the farthest corners of the intergalactic world. But the key word of the title really is Earth in this one. And it is a very kind of like, you know, Doctor Who can be so fantastical sometimes. And this was, I would say, like grittier.
Yeah, and more literal and grounded.
Yeah, very grounded. And it's the episode is set in Sheffield. And it's pretty much a normal presentation of Sheffield, you know, with a few obvious departures. So I quite liked that they immediately bring Jodie Whittaker in as the 13th Doctor in this quite like relatable background. And obviously each time that there's a regeneration, quite often there's a new sort of showrunner as well. And now we've got Chris Chibnall taking, he didn't do the last season, right?
I don't think so. This is where I show my ignorance of all things Doctor Who. I am pretty sure he has been a writer on Doctor Who for a while, doing like a few episodes a series.
Doing episodes here and there, yeah. Which is how they normally come in.
Yeah, I think he's now taken over from Stephen Moffat as like the whole thing. And I'm pretty sure I read somewhere that, that's right, yeah, I did. I read an article, a behind the scenes article that BuzzFeed did about the new Doctor Who, where he was one of the voices in it. And he'd said that having the new Doctor be cast as a woman was one of his like hard rules for taking the job. And the other thing was that he wanted to introduce like complete parity with everyone. So like more women producers, more women camera operators, like everything.
I really liked
which
that.
Was cool. That was nice of him.
Yeah. And Jodie Whittaker, I've seen mainly in Broadchurch before this. And I did really like her in that, but it's completely different kind of role where she was playing like concerned and grieving parent. And in this, she's really bubbly, which I'm now like, that's not a word you would have used for the David Tennant Doctor, but there's loads of similarities there.
Yeah, I think there are too. I think she's very David Tennant-y. She's very energetic and full of like non sequiturs and throwing out like random phrases all over the place.
And effervescent.
And David Tennant used to do this, effervescent is a good word actually. David Tennant used to do this thing all the time where he like interrupted himself as he was thinking as he was talking, and she was doing she was doing the exact same thing,
which I really like actually. And it's nice to see that. It's funny to think like that you wouldn't have expected us to be discussing a female doctor and being like, actually she's really similar to the other doctors, but in that sense she is really similar to a preceding male doctor, so that's actually weirdly quite comforting, because although you do want each regeneration to be different, you do want them to still essentially feel like the same character, because they are for all intents and purposes deep down the same character. And I like that it felt like a continuation rather than a like crazy departure. That's probably more important for her as a woman coming in to achieve than for it to just be totally different. And then she obviously gets her assistance, and she has a vlogger.
Yes.
She's very, very trendy for her.
Very
century.
Trendy. Yes.
A dyspraxic vlogger.
She has Ryan,
which I quite like,
the vlogger, and Yaz, who's a policewoman.
She's like a trainee cop, isn't she? Yeah.
And then, is it Gary? Graham. They all look the same to me. The
the man.
The older white man who is introduced in this episode through this really sad episode of he's sort of Ryan's step granddad. He's his gran's second husband, and she dies in the course of like saving the world from monsters. Graham is sort of like on the edge of the crew as a result.
He's like Bradley Walsh, if, you know, the Americans listening won't know who Bradley Walsh is, but it's quite funny to see Bradley Walsh aged up for this course. really funny. And he's got like kind of got extra lines and extra weird hair, and it's quite funny. And I don't know, I haven't watched any of the last few seasons of Doctor Who, so I don't know how much this is a departure or not, but it felt very accessible to children for me, which I think is a really important part of Doctor Who. I don't like it when it's too adult. I think it should remain accessible for children, and I think this really pulled that off, because like it right, you know, in the deep end of the David Tennant, Matt Smith Doctor Who series, there was a lot of, you know, what they called wibbly wobbly timey wimey stuff that became like in these big overarching plots that became so incredibly confusing. Yeah. I'm just like, surely the kids watching, like the adults watching, obviously aren't following it because it actually doesn't make sense. So what hope the kids have, I don't know. Whereas this didn't feel like that. And apparently Chris Chibnall is not going to do a big overarching plot like the Bad Wolf plot and other overarching Doctor Who
plots. That's a smart decision.
I think it's a good decision.
Yeah.
Because also the most iconic Doctor Who episodes really are ones that stand alone really well. And I think, you know, like, I think of, sorry, I'm like really letting my old inner Doctor Who fan come out, but I, you know, the gas mask children episode and Blink, like these are the iconic Doctor Who episodes, and they really have no bearing on a longer plot, essentially.
Yeah, definitely. I very much associate, I mean, I think the first time when Russell T Davies did that with the Bad Wolf one,
yeah, it was great.
Was great, and especially because it had never happened before, you didn't know it was happening, and then when you got to the sort of finale and they were like Bad Wolf, and you were suddenly like, oh shit, people have been saying Bad Wolf this entire series and I didn't know why. And that was really mind-blowing, but it had decreasing returns and became more and more complicated to pull off and required a lot of stupid exposition, and I think really detracted from the whole thing. So I'm pleased to hear that he's not going to do that, and hopefully just focus on making good standalone or like two-parter episodes that, as you say, are enjoyable for children who are ultimately supposed to be the audience of the show.
Yeah, and I hope that there's like, I think we talked about this last week, but the stats seem to show that more girls are watching than ever before, which is just great, isn't it? Like, you just can't argue with stuff like that. That's just brilliant. I'm really happy to see that.
Yeah, and I really enjoyed this. I was pleased to see that they didn't spend a lot of time addressing the fact that she's a woman now. There were just a couple of occasions where Jodie Whittaker was like, I think there was one even where she asked Yaz, like, why do you keep saying she, and she was like, oh, because you're a woman. She's like, oh, am I? Haven't been for a while, you know, and just that was it. There wasn't any,
that's nice.
You know, that was really good, I thought.
Yeah.
And then also lots of other bits where they didn't seem to be taking it so seriously. So like, I remember when the press photo of her in the new outfit was published, and lots of people were like, oh, what is this? She looks ridiculous. How can this? Because she's wearing kind of short trousers and yellow braces. But then the scene where it comes from, she's like in a charity shop trying on loads and loads of clothes. And then when she pulls the curtain back to be like, look, I found it, her new friends are like, that's what you want to wear? Okay. You know, so it's sort of, is part of a little piece of humor, and it becomes an in-joke rather than like,
yeah,
the doctor thinks nice. She looks awesome, you know.
Yeah, that was a nice bit. I also just want to shout out to the press material for this, because I've really loved the slogan that they went for this series, which was "It's about time."
I know.
Which I just it's so silly and so good. I just love that. It's about time.
And every time I saw that on Twitter, I just thought, give the person who thought of that a raise.
A medal,
it's
yeah.
Really,
it's
funny.
Just great.
So I have enjoyed it. I have mostly avoided the is Doctor Who good/bad now takes, because I honestly couldn't care. I will stop watching it again in a heartbeat if I find it boring. I am not a loyal viewer of Doctor Who, sorry. But I think I'm going to watch the next couple and see how it goes. I did find Jodie Whittaker engaging. I like her. I like it when the Doctor has multiple companions. Like, I always enjoyed, what was Rose's boyfriend name?
I don't know, but isn't the guy, isn't, The guy's called like Noel something.
Yeah.
I know exactly who he is.
Yeah. Anyway, so I liked it when Dr. Rose and boyfriend used to travel together, ditto Amy and Rory, you know.
Yeah.
So I think it's better when it's not, well, up until now, it's always been like older male character, younger female companion, yeah, hasn't it? So I like it when they don't do that, basically. It's more interesting.
And this also gives them the freedom where if like there's a, if there's a key relationship that it brings the most to the, you know, if two characters end up having the best tension and the best dynamic, then you can lead more heavily with that. But they've kind of got time to figure that out, which I like.
Also, no River Song.
Yeah.
Which is great relief to me.
Always a great relief. Anyway, I'm glad you enjoyed it, actually, Caroline, because I kind of went in skeptical in it. I didn't think it was bad at all. Mm. So for next week, I've been, over the last month or so, getting into, very, very belatedly getting into BoJack Horseman, which I've seen bits and bobs of, and I believe you've also seen bits and bobs of.
I've seen a few episodes, but not in a kind of concerted or concentrated way.
So we're going to have a little chat about some of the early episodes of BoJack Horseman. Maybe if we both really get into it, we'll end up doing like a season 4 discussion as a main item on Seriously sometime. But for now, we're just going to be belated and proud and talk about the beginning of BoJack Horseman. So stay tuned for that next week. Thanks for listening to this episode of Seriously, the pop culture podcast from The New Statesman.
If you enjoyed the show, why not subscribe to make sure you never miss another episode? We're available in all the usual places you get podcasts, including on Apple Podcasts, where you could leave us a rating and a review if you fancy. It makes us happy and it also helps other people find the show.
If you'd like to come and see us in person, check out the events page of our website, seriouslypod.com/events. Details of our next pop culture quiz and anything else we're doing will appear there.
We're available many other places on the internet, including on Twitter, Facebook and Tumblr. We're Seriously Pod on all of them. Follow us to keep up with what we're up to or to chat to other listeners about things you've enjoyed on the show.
We love getting your recommendations for things we should feature on the show or hearing your thoughts on what we've already discussed. Get in touch on social media or email us on seriouslypod@gmail.com.
And if you feel strongly that more pop culture needs to be taken seriously, spread the word and tell your friends and family about the podcast.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Hey, everyone. Craig Robinson here. I want you to check out the Ways to Win podcast, brought to you by Ford and the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. On Ways to Win, Coach Cal and I will discuss leadership lessons we've learned. We know all about the days spent perfecting your craft outside of the limelight and have knowledge to share about how strength, inspiration, encouragement, and adaptability are the key ingredients to drive toward your dreams. And those same ingredients can be found in the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. So check out my podcast, Ways to Win, and also check out the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. Learn more at Ford.com. Built Ford tough, built Ford proud.